The book of Job, where many people are afraid to study. Job's name, of course, a byword, and he even says that about himself. He says that his name became a byword in his own day. A name synonymous with suffering, a name synonymous with the need for the grace of God, grace in the sense of being able to make it through just one more day. To restart our background in Job, and we will be in chapter 11 this evening. We'll be going from chapter 11 to chapter 14. Job, as you know, has lost not just a little bit. He hasn't taken just one or two hits. He's lost everything. He's lost all that is valuable to a human being. He's lost his family. He's lost his livelihood. He's lost his home. Actually, several homes in the patriarchal world of his day. His sons' homes would have been considered part of his inheritance as well. All of it has been lost. All of his livestock, everything. He was a man who had really everything going for him and was godly, absolutely down to his toes. And then the Lord allowed a test into his life, completely reducing his life literally to nothing. And then he lost his health on top of that. So that by the time we see him in chapter 3 and pretty much all the way through the book, he is sitting on an ash heap. The entire text of Job takes place with Job and his friends sitting on an ash heap, Job covered with boils and sores. And the interaction between his friends and him with regard to why in the world is God allowing this to happen to me. The entire dialogue of Job, all of the poetry, has to do with that question. Why is this being allowed in my life? This is, remember, not a discipline in Job's life. This has to be borne in mind. The calamity he's enduring is not a discipline. It's not because he's done something wrong. It's not because he's in sin. And we know that from the first two chapters. I'll repeat that over and over again, because after you read Job for a while, you begin to ask the same questions everybody else is asking. What did this guy do to really tick the Lord off? But he didn't do anything. We know that from the very beginning, that the Lord brought this or allowed this test. Actually, Satan kind of brought it on in terms of the destruction. But God is behind it. God is behind it. Even when Satan does something, God is allowing it purposely for a good reason. Job doesn't know the good reason. And Job and his friends have a difficult time because their theology, as I've mentioned 3 weeks running now, their theology is pretty much the same, even though Job's at the other end of the theology. Their theology is strict legalism. If you're good, God will bless you. If you're bad, God will curse you. You can tell how blessed you are in the Lord by how much money you have, by how healthy you are, by how beautiful you are, and so on. And if you're not any of those things, then you must have made God mad. It's quite simple. It's a very legalistic view of life. And it's a very common view of life. And it's why people usually come before the Lord if something goes wrong with their life, and they say, what did I do wrong? That's always, almost always the first thing we ask. Lord, have I done something wrong? For a godly person, that's actually not a bad question to ask. We do want to know if we've done something wrong. And then after having straightened that out, we tend to think that things ought to get better real quick. And if it doesn't get better real quick, then we're presented with the same kind of dilemma that Job was presented with. In Job's case, he hadn't been doing anything wrong. As a matter of fact, he was doing so many things right that he became an object of testing, which, as I mentioned before, might want you to keep back just a little bit from doing as many things right as you might be inclined to do. But don't live that way. Still do everything right, okay? In Job's case, his faith was tested. Yours will be as well. And once you've confessed whatever known sin there is, if there is any, and you know you're walking with God, if the test continues, you are in a situation not unlike Job's. Now, his three friends came. As you know, they sat with him, and they supposedly came to comfort him. It actually says they came to comfort him. But as you know, through the entire dialogue, there was very little comfort from these guys. And the reason was because their theology was the same as Job's. They believed that if you're sick or something's wrong, if you're in your life externally, there must be some sort of secret hidden sin. And Job does not start out well with his friends because in his opening talk, his opening speech in chapter 3, he basically emotionally sort of throws up on them. I mean, he says, I want to die. I hate my life. And furthermore, I think that God is unjust, and he just unloads all of this bile out of his heart after laying around for weeks or who knows how long with the sores and losing everything, and his life is just a complete mess. And he pours all this out. Well, this ticks off his friends because they came there to help him, and they were hoping that his theology would be the same as theirs and that they would all get together and say, well, praise the Lord. I'm so glad I've got boils. I'm so glad my life fell apart. Did you ever want desperately for someone else to say something really, really faithful and they didn't? And it kind of ticked you off a little bit. Matter of fact, if they didn't over a long period of time, did you ever feel like you ought to say, well, come on, snap out of it, because you're feeling like, well, I can't hold on to you. I can't support your faith anymore. Did you ever have that kind of a feeling with somebody? That's the way his friends are feeling, and it causes the friends to do something very natural, to get angry. In fact, from the very beginning, they're angry at Job, and Job responds in anger. It's an angry book. These guys are ticked off at each other in a way, all the way through the book. So Job starts out by saying, I hate my life and I want to die. His first friend, Eliphaz, chapters 4 and 5, says, Job, I love you, but it's all your fault. So repent. Thank you very much. Now, this is the only thing they can say because their theology says, basically, if you're in trouble, you've got some secret sin. Eliphaz kind of gently says, it's your fault. Job says, thanks a lot in chapter 6. These are simple headings, and we covered them last week. He says, thanks a lot. You guys are useless friends. Chapter 7, Job says, I want to complain to the Lord about this life I have. And his first couple of verses basically say, my life stinks, and so do I. And so I want to argue with God. Well, they hear what he has to say to God, and it ticks his other friend off, Bildad, who comes in chapter 8, and he says, this is all your fault because God doesn't let this sort of thing happen to good people. That was in chapter 8. He says, Job, you're full of hot air, first 7 verses of chapter 8. You can just kind of trace it through for yourself. You're full of hot air, and he implies that the fact that his children died was because something that they did wrong. Again, that theology coming back, that's what's making all this happen. And he says, check with the traditions of the aged. Don't they all tell you that this is the way it is? People who forget God will wither like a plant without water. And he's looking at this guy who's looking pretty withered, right? So Job's thinking, oh boy, Bildad's down on me now. And he ends it in chapter 8. Bildad ends by saying, God will never let a person of integrity down. Meaning, if you had integrity, Job, you wouldn't be in this mess. Chapter 9, Job basically says, I know, but there's just no talking to the Lord about this. Because Job's been crying out to God all the way along, and he's not getting an answer. He's not getting an answer. And sometimes it is that way, by the way. Sometimes the Lord gives answers when we're not asking, and sometimes when we are most desperate to hear something from God now, he's not answering the phone. Have you noticed that? By the way, if that is your situation, realize one of the main things we learned from Job is that God was not absent, even though Job couldn't talk to him and accused him of being absent, or at least absent-minded. Matter of fact, he gets downright rude with the Lord at a couple of points. That does not mean the Lord is not there. What it means is you simply have to trust the last thing you heard from him, because he will at times make great silence in our life. And he will simply say, I want you to go on the wisdom that I've already given you. And you know what we do at that point? Where was that? I know that was around here somewhere. Where are my notes from the last Bible study I was at? But you know, that's not a bad exercise. That is not a bad exercise to have to go back and say, well, Lord, what was that? Where is wisdom? Lord, I really do need more wisdom. And if you're not going to talk to me audibly or providentially open certain things up and really tell me what I'm supposed to do, then I'm going to have to wait here and I'm going to have to trust that you're going to give me wisdom. What was that? That's a good exercise. You know, sometimes you learn more great stuff at moments like that, and you come back later in your life and you say, you know, this was a gem the Lord gave to me at a time when everything looked dark, and I dove in to the Word, or I dove into the last things that he was telling me, and it made all the difference in the world. I had a good friend who dove into the last piece of wisdom that he had His name is Tom. And he doesn't go to this church, and in all probability will not hear this tape, but I would not be ashamed if he did, because I'm proud of him now. He was a young man that I discipled over 20 years ago, and for several years we worked together. And after I left the area and came up here, this is in Southern California, Tom moved to Hawaii and got involved in a very lucrative business, not dishonest at all, just very good business, but very lucrative. And he began to make quite a bit of money, and it's an interesting thing. At the same time, began to turn away from the Lord. Now, that doesn't always happen, but in his case, it did. And I lost track of him, and he lost track of spiritual things for a period of, I believe it was 8 years. And then we happened to have been in Hawaii on a vacation, and of course, we looked Tom up, and we talked with him. And I realized after talking with him what was going on. And we did not just lay into him or anything like that. You know, we had a good time with him, really. We really enjoyed. But it was obvious he wasn't walking with God. I mean, it's just real obvious. So we prayed for him, and I left a book with him, and he read it and so on. And then a wonderful thing happened. A glorious, glorious thing happened that made Tom turn back to the last piece of wisdom that he had. His partner, his business partner, ran off with all, not some, all the money. He left all the debts for the business with Tom, embezzled the entire thing and took off. And that absolutely rocked Tom to the point where he said, I want to get back to the Lord. And the next time we saw him, the next time we went to Hawaii, which was a couple years later, it was like the exact same guy from 10 years ago. It was absolutely uncanny. I mean, we said, Tom, you're back. It was like someone else had inhabited his body for 8 years. Not really. I'm not talking demonism here, but it was, and he went back so much so that the same worship songs we used to sing, he was singing. Literally picked up exactly where he had left off. And he's serving the Lord now with YWAM overseas. And in the mission field, and has been on fire ever since. It is not always a bad thing when the Lord makes you go back to that last piece of wisdom because he's being so quiet about what's going on. And you say, okay, I'm going to keep going back in my mind until I know I was walking with God, and I'm going to start right there. That's what happened in Tom's life. But it's the silence of God that makes us do that. If we feel like the Lord's going to constantly come instantly every single time, give us an audible direction or something like that all the time, you know what we would do? We would treat him like a taxi driver. We would treat him like a gas station attendant. We would just have him doing everything for us, and then we'd get upset if he wasn't right on time. You know how we are, don't you? I mean, isn't that the way we are? We take him for granted real quick. And so he has these times of great silence. Now, in Job's life, that's exactly what's going on here. Except in Job's life, neither Job nor his friends, since they lived 2000 BC, didn't have a theology strong enough until after this was done. They didn't have a theology strong enough to know that God actually tests people, that his purpose often is to test, and that it's not bad, it's good. So they get down to the end of chapter 9, and silence has been there. God and Job has said, the Lord's not talking to me, and he's beating me up, and he's letting all this stuff happen, and I don't have any confidence that he's going to listen to me. Chapter 10, he has just said in chapter 9, I don't want to talk to him because I don't think he's going to listen. And then in chapter 10, the heading is, but I'm going to talk anyway, because he just can't hold it in. So he just lays out all kinds of stuff. He says basically three things in chapter 10. He says, you're unfair to oppress me. And he accuses God of actually doing the very thing God says he hates, oppression. The abuse of power. The abuse of power is the Hebrew word, a shock. And he accuses God of this. God is the one who accuses Israel of it many, many years after Job. And Job actually accuses God of this same thing. He was a very angry man to accuse the Lord of this terrible thing. The second thing he says is, you're unfair to create me and then allow this to happen to me, to prosecute me. He says, you hid the truth from me that if you're going to create me, you're going to hound me to death. Now, you know he's not thinking straight at that point. But when you're really upset, your life has really gone south and you don't know why, you tend to say these kind of things. And then finally he says, you were wrong not to send me straight to the tomb from the womb.
In chapter 10, verses 18 to 22, this is the last thing he says, and his third friend, Zophar, picks up on it, and that's why I'm bringing you up to speed on it. But look at verses 18 to 22. Why, then, have you brought me out of the womb? Would that I had died, and no eye had seen me. Look at the mess I'm in. It would be better if I had never been born. It should have been as though I had not been, carried from womb to tomb. Would he not let my few days alone withdraw from me, that I may have a little cheer? Now, you see, we worship the Lord because we know that in his presence is great cheer. But Job is so twisted in his thinking. He's thinking God is doing all of this to him, and he thinks it's terribly unfair. So he says, get away from me so I can have a little joy. You know when you're thinking that you're thinking wrong. Well, you know when you think that in order to get some peace, I got to get away from God. We won't have a show of hands. But has that ever crossed your mind? Have you ever been so pressed, and this happens in ministry, have you ever been so involved in something that at moments you thought to yourself, if I'm going to have any mental peace, I'm going to have to get away from the Lord, or at least away from his work? You know, it's okay to get away from work. It's okay to take a break and Sabbath. But if you really think that in order to have any peace, you have to get away from God, you are not thinking straight. You're thinking crooked. And whatever events have transpired in your life, get a grip on your mind, because it really is in the presence of God that the peace is found. Now, Job does one thing right all the way through the book, and you'll see it. He does some things wrong, but one thing he does right, and that is he says, I've still got to talk to God. I've got to talk to God. He knows he needs to talk to him, but in his moments of bitterness, he says, oh man, get away from me so I can have some peace. And then he ends, before I go, and I shall not return. Don't you get the feeling like, I'm leaving now, okay? I'm going now, I'm leaving now, and you're going to miss me, I'm leaving. To the land of darkness and deep shadow, he thinks he's going to die. The land of utter gloom as darkness itself, of deep shadow without order, and which shines in the darkness. Now Zophar, his third friend, jumps on the bandwagon at this point. If his other two friends haven't railed on him enough, Zophar is the worst. He is the most caustic of all three of these guys. Zophar the Naamathite answered. And he said, shall a multitude of words go unanswered and a talkative man be acquitted? Shall your boasts silence men, and shall you scoff and none rebuke? For you have said, my teaching is pure and I'm innocent in your eyes. But would that God might speak and open his lips against you and show you the secrets of wisdom. For sound wisdom has two sides. Know then that God actually forgets part of your iniquity. In other words, what he's saying is, you're lucky to be alive. God's already forgotten half your iniquity, and you must have a whole lot left over to be in this much trouble. Verse 7, can you discover the depths of God? Can you discover the limits of the Almighty? They are as high as the heavens. What can you do? They are deeper than Sheol. What can you know? He's really ragging on Job badly here. Its measure is longer than the earth and broader than the sea. If he passes by or shuts up or calls an assembly, who can restrain him? He knows false men, and he sees iniquity without investigating. Hint, 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 hint. Verse 12. The New American Standard renders this, and an idiot will become intelligent when the foal of a donkey is born to a man. Say what? Friend, what are you getting at? I mean, you know, if you don't already see what he's getting at. Do you see what Zophar, now he takes Job's recent harangue and he says, Job, you are an arrogant idiot, basically is what he calls him, and you need to get right with God. Zophar says, you are an arrogant idiot, Job, get right with God. In the first six verses, he says, you're arrogant and you're in denial about your secret sin, which, of course, he had no idea what it was. But his theology was such that, hey, man, there must be some sort of secret sin in there, or you wouldn't be having this kind of trouble. To this very day, there are people who will pick at other people about secret sin based on basically the same kind of logic. Be very careful what you assume about another person's life. Unless you know for sure what's going on in another person's soul, which is rare. Unless you know exactly what's going on in another person's soul, be very careful what you say. I mean, these guys were close friends, And they should have actually said, you know, it doesn't seem right that a guy that was this good for this long should have fallen this far. But if our theology is right, he must have done something wrong. That's what they're thinking now. They didn't give him the benefit of the doubt. They didn't say, you know, maybe there's something going on in there we don't understand. If you see something going on in a person's life that you don't really see how it's, what's going, you know, you don't understand what's going on, don't jump to conclusions. Be careful about that. It's easy to do, especially if you're ticked off. But wait until the facts come out. Now, the first thing he says is, it's your secret sin, which, of course, he had no idea what it was. And Job had actually asked him, his friends, before. He said, do you guys know what this is? You know what this secret sin is? Tell me. Somebody tell me what it is. Because there wasn't one. And then, in verses 7 to 12, he calls him basically an idiot. The Hebrew word nadab means hollow. He's calling him an airhead. He literally is calling him a hollow man, a hollow man. NIV renders it witless. An idiot or a witless man or a hollow man will become intelligent when the foal of a donkey is born to a man, meaning you are never going to get this, Job. You are absolutely wrong. And he's basing it all on his theology and throwing everything he knows about Job out the window. In the next few verses, verses 13 to 20, he basically tells him the same thing they've all said in the past. You need to repent, everything will be okay. Because we know there must be something wrong, so you got to repent, everything will be okay. If you would direct your heart right and spread out your hand to him, if iniquity is in your hand, put it far away. And do not let wickedness dwell in your tents. Then, well, of course, Job had never done that. Can you imagine Job sitting there with his boils? You know, he's sitting on the ash heap, and he's covered, and he hurts, you know, and he's listening to Zophar say this stuff, and he's thinking of his tents, and he's thinking of the fact that he sacrificed to the Lord every day, and he was totally walking with God, and there was nothing wrong with his walk with God. And here's Zophar saying, look, don't let wickedness dwell in your tents. Man, verse 15. Then indeed you could lift up your face without moral defect, and you would be steadfast and not fear. And you would forget your trouble and the waters that have passed, you would, as waters that have passed, you would remember it. And your life would be brighter than noonday. Darkness would be like the morning. And then you would trust because there is hope. And you would look around and rest securely. And you would lie down and none would disturb you. And many would entreat your favor. Ah, but the eyes of the wicked will fail. And there will be no escape for them. And their hope is to breathe their last. And here's a guy sitting covered with boils, lost everything, and that's what he's telling him. Now, the interesting thing, and you saw it with Eliphaz, and you saw it with Bildad, and you see it now with Zophar, the interesting thing is there's a kernel of truth in here. If it was really true that the cause of all of this was some hidden sin, but it wasn't. If it were really true that this was a discipline from God, then turning back to the Lord would be the way, the first step. If it was a discipline. But in this case, it's not a discipline. And all this is basically a super simplistic bless me theology, which is the fruit of an overprotected life. People who have a super simplistic kind of bless me theology, who have no compassion for people whose lives have fallen apart, are people who've never had their lives fall apart. And one of the best things that happens to us when something goes wrong in our life is it teaches us grace and wisdom for other people. And that's one of the reasons why, hopefully, the older we get, the more things go wrong in our lives, the more we are actually, in a sense, crushed. And we say, Lord, I didn't want to be crushed. I liked myself all shiny and new and strong and bulletproof. But the problem is, that's not really good equipment for ministry. Being bulletproof doesn't help you minister to people who are in a lot of pain and a lot of hurt. But having been through a lot of pain and a lot of hurt, that helps you minister. It teaches you compassion. I guarantee you, Bildad had never lost everything. You can tell by how he talks. Bildad had never gone through the hard times that he's seeing his friend Job. And that's why he was never able to comfort him. None of these guys were. An overprotected, super safe life in which there has been no doubt, no fear, no concept of coming before the Lord and having to cry out to him is a life that doesn't produce a lot of compassion and wisdom. Is it any wonder then that when we say, Lord, teach me compassion, teach me wisdom, more importantly, Lord, let me really represent you well in a dying world, that he allows us to endure trauma. He allows us to endure grief. And he allows us to be around when other people are enduring grief. That's because he's teaching us how to think like he thinks. Now listen, you guys, they didn't understand about Jesus, and we do. The wonderful thing about Jesus Christ is that he's not like any other person who supposedly speaks for God out there in the world. All the other ones are well protected. But Jesus came absolutely vulnerable and endured the worst that humanity could ever endure or could ever dish out, so that we could never say to our Lord, "You don't understand how I feel." And we could never accuse him of not actually entering into the hassle and the horror of being a human being in a fallen world. And then we say, "Lord, I want to be like you." And he says, "Okay, then I'm going to allow a certain amount of pain and a certain amount of anguish. Some more and some less, but it will hurt. Because if it doesn't hurt, you won't be able to comfort." And a good place to find people who don't comfort well, I hate to say it, is Bible college and seminary, and I've been there and done that, so I know that a lot of times the people who are involved in high-level training for ministry do not have a lot of life experience, a lot of times because they're young. And they come out of seminaries and Bible colleges bristling with lots and lots of stuff to say and answers to questions people aren't even asking sometimes. And then what they need is get beat up in the ministry for a few years. And then it kind of settles into something that is like what ministry is really about, which is very similar to family life, very similar to parenting, very similar to all the hassles and ups and downs and trials of being involved in a large family. That's what being a believer is about. It's not about just sitting in a classroom and taking notes on stuff. It's about being out there where the hurt is and where the pain is a lot of times, and the joy too. A life overprotected, a life just cram-packed with lots of facts about God, is not really very well prepared to actually minister. That's a good foundation. But then what you need is to just be kind of worn down around the edges so that you say, "I want some wisdom, Lord. Teach me how to be compassionate. Teach me how to be patient. Teach me how to be quiet. Teach me how to hold back when my friend is hurting so badly." That comes with hurt. That comes with pain. Bildad didn't have that. He had a lot of shiny answers, and he had a lot of really pretty good theology in some ways, but it was all misapplied. Job comes back at him. In chapters 12, 13, and 14, Job's speeches are getting longer, by the way, if you've noticed. And he is not running out of steam. For a guy who's really sick, he's very eloquent, okay? And he's got a lot of emotion. Chapter 12, Job responded, "Oh, yeah. You're the man, and when you die, all wisdom will die with you." Do you get the feeling from that first line? That is exactly what he's saying. "Oh, yeah, Bildad, you're the man. I can see him just throw a few ashes on him. Oh, yeah, you're the man, and I suppose when you die, all wisdom's going to die with you." But he says, "I'm as smart as you," verse 3. "I have intelligence as well as you, and I am not inferior to you. Don't look down on me. Don't be telling me. Don't give me this basic theology stuff. I know that God is right and humans are wrong. I know that." Man, who doesn't know this kind of stuff? The end of verse 4. "I have become a joke to my friends." The one who called on God and he answered him, and the just and the blameless man, he's become a joke. Verse 5. "The person who sits at ease holds calamity in contempt, as prepared for those whose feet slip." In other words, if you're not having the calamity, it's easy for you to point the finger and say, "Well, it must be all your fault. That's what's going on here." Verse 6, "The tents of the destroyers prosper. Those who provoke God are secure." And I like the NIV rendering of the last line, "People who carry their gods around in their hands." I like that. He says, how come these guys are winning? Now, see, he had not read Psalm 37, which we're going to get to in the book of Job. We'll see that. We'll move into that. But Job lived 2,000 years B.C., 4,000 years ago, before David wrote the Psalms. Job didn't know that he was becoming a foundation stone for all the rest of us to understand about pain. He didn't know that. And so he didn't know that there are things to be said about why evil people seem to prosper. But when he says it here, he says, look, I've become a joke. People who are evil are doing well. Don't you give me any theology lessons. I'm just as wise as you are. verses 7 to 12. Ask the beasts. Let them teach you. The birds of the heaven, let them tell you. Everybody knows this. Speak the truth. Let it teach you. Let the fish of the sea tell you these things. Who among all these does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this? Anybody in the universe not know that God is sovereign? That's what Job says. Well, you know what? He's actually right. You know, even the creation knows that God is sovereign. It is only certain human beings that don't believe that God is sovereign. One thing Job had right all along was that God knew what was going on and was allowing it. That Job knew. What he didn't know was why. And his theology of strict legalism told him something was wrong and he couldn't put his hand on it. He didn't understand it. But he did know that God was sovereign. You know, it's interesting, in our day, people don't believe that. Many people don't believe that God is sovereign. Job says, even the creation knows that God is sovereign. You're not telling me anything I don't know already, Zophar. Verse 10, in whose hand is the life of every living thing and the breath of all mankind. Does not the ear test words and the palate taste its food? Wisdom is with the aged. Would that that were always the case, but that's the principle. Wisdom is with the aged. With long life is understanding. In other words, I understand these things and I know what you're saying. Verses 13 to 25, he basically does his own theology lesson. He goes right back to Zophar and all the rest of his buds who are sitting right there. And he says, with him are wisdom and might. To him belong counsel and understanding. Behold, he tears down, it cannot be rebuilt. He imprisons a man, there's no release. Behold, he restrains the waters, they dry up. He sends them out and they inundate the earth. With him are strength and sound wisdom. The misled and the misleader both belong to him. He makes counselors walk barefoot. You know, might not want to put that up in the counseling offices here at TCF. He makes fools of judges. And he goes all the way through this thing, really laying out the sovereignty and the power and the dominion of God. It is this very reality that's bothering Job the most. If God is this sovereign and I haven't done anything wrong, why? Why? He doesn't need a theology lesson from Zophar or Bildad or Eliphaz. He knows it well. This is actually wonderful poetry, and it's good theology about how sovereign God is, but it doesn't help when you're going through grief. To know that God is sovereign when someone you love has been taken away from you in death, in an untimely death especially, to have someone say, well, you know, God is sovereign, does not help. Even though you know it's true, and I know it's true, it doesn't help the feeling, because what it does is it makes you ask the question, why? If he's sovereign, then couldn't he sovereignly figure out a way to accomplish his will without me losing my child? Without my spouse running away? Without my life caving in? Couldn't he figure it out? And I know how big God is, and I know how smart God is. And it's the very knowledge of his sovereignty that causes the dilemma. Job and his friends all understood the sovereignty of God very, very well, and they were correct about it. They didn't know Romans 8:28. They didn't understand about how God can use pain and how he uses calamity, but they did know that he was sovereign. When you're comforting somebody who's going through grief, it's best not to remind them of the sovereignty of God, at least not blatantly, not right up front. Because, like I said, it doesn't help very much at the time. Later, it might, but we all know it anyway. Better to just cry along with them. Job, rattling back at him, says, look, I know these things. Chapter 13, there shouldn't be a chapter heading there. He just goes straight on. Behold, my eye has seen all this. My ear has heard and understood it. Why, what you know, I also know, he says. I am not inferior to you. He starts it in chapter 12 that way. He ends it in the first part of chapter 13. I know these things. I'm not an idiot, despite what you said so far, and I caught what you said there about being an airhead. I do know. I understand these things, but I want to talk to God. And that's exactly what he rings the changes on this over and over and over again. He says, basically, my theology is as good as yours, but I want to talk to God. And 13 and 14 is where he starts to talk about wanting to talk to God. He says, I would speak to the Almighty. I desire to argue with God. But you smear with lies. You guys, you're all worthless physicians. Oh, that you would be completely silent. That would be your wisdom. You want wisdom? You want to lose 20 pounds of ugly fat? Cut off your head. I had a guy tell me that one time. And that's kind of what they're saying. He's saying to them, just be quiet. Best thing you can do is just put a sock in it. You know, that would help me if you just shut up. You say, well, that's kind of strong. Well, actually, it is very strong. It's very strong. He's upset. He's sparring with them. He says, I want to talk to God. I don't want to talk to you guys. Verse 6, please hear my argument. Listen to the contention of my lips. Will you speak what is unjust for God? You're telling me stuff that's wrong, and I know it's wrong because I know what's going on in my soul, and you're saying you're speaking for God and you're misrepresenting him. That's what he's accusing him of. You're misrepresenting God because you don't know what's going on in my soul, and you're saying things to me directly. Now, this isn't in a group. This isn't in a group where you're doing a message and it might or might not apply, and if the shoe fits, wear it and all that stuff. This is where they have a shoe and they're putting it on his foot whether it fits or not, and it's an individual thing, and he says, you're misrepresenting God. He says, I don't want to talk to you. I want to talk to God because you don't know what's going on inside of me, and I can tell by what you're saying that you think the wrong thing. What a terrible feeling. You're going to speak unjust things for God and speak what is deceitful for him? You're going to show partiality for him? The idea is you're falsifying things in order to make this fit your theology, and you think that it's glorifying God, and it's not. That's what he's saying here. You're showing partiality. You think you're glorifying God. You're really not. You're going to contend for God? Will it be well when he examines you? You know, what if the Lord comes down and asks you, and I know it's going to, you know, he's so frustrated because he knows what's in his soul. He says, when the Lord gets a hold of you, I'll tell you, he's going to straighten your stuff out. You think that he's going to put up with this? Will you deceive him as one deceives a man? Ooh. He says, you guys can talk about me all you want, but God knows the truth. When he gets here, you're not going to be able to pull the wool over his eyes, and all of your little lightweight theology is not going to wash. And by the way, when the Lord finally does show up on the scene, that's exactly what happens. And Job is rebuked for his impudence to the Lord. But his three friends are fired. They are. It's like the Lord says, clean out your offices. We're getting new counselors here in Jobville. When we get to that part, you'll see. They were wrong, and they had misrepresented God. You know, it is a fine line between righteous indignation, where you really are saying what is right and correct on behalf of the Lord's word, on behalf of the Lord, in an evil circumstance where you need to speak the truth. It's a fine line between that, which is a good thing, and plain old angry self-righteousness, where often we who know the Lord, all these guys knew the Lord, they all did. We who know the Lord can cross the line with people sometimes. And I know it better than anybody because I've done it as a pastor. You can cross the line and find out later you misrepresented God and you misrepresented his word by jumping on something too hard, too quickly, without thinking it through. Just because it hit a hot button for you and you just and the indignation is so strong. It's like, wow, I got to say something here. Boom. And afterwards, you're sorry you said it. All ministers know that feeling. Be careful. Be wise. Don't misrepresent the Lord. And that's what Job's three friends did. And Job accuses him of it. He says, you're misrepresenting the Lord. He's not going to be happy. I don't want to talk to you. I want to talk to God. And he says basically the same thing. Look at verse 12. Verse 11, he says, will not his majesty terrify you? Boy, oh boy, and I want to watch. And the dread of him fall on you? Yes. Oh, kill him, Lord. Verse 12, your memorable sayings are proverbs of ashes. Your defenses are defenses of clay. Ah, he nails him. Be silent before me so that I can speak. Let come on me what may. I got to talk to God. Get out of here. It's like he's pushing past the secretaries, right? Going to go in and talk to God. I would take my flesh in my teeth and put my life in his hands. Though he slay me, yet I will hope in him, which is a great verse. Nevertheless, I will argue my ways before him. What it really means is if he kills me, I'm still going to argue with him. That's actually what that verse means. If he kills me, I want him to kill me. I don't want to be killed by your stupidity. Let me go talk to God. You know, it's very emotional. But it really shows one thing. He's very trusting of the fact that if he can just get into the main office and talk to God, it'll make him feel better. And it does, actually. Even though the Lord rebukes him, he's at least glad to just hear his voice. And actually, that is the mark of a person who understands something of the Lord. So he goes on with that. He says, why do you want to contend with me? Then in verse 20 and down to the end of chapter 14, he talks directly to God. He says, look, verse 20, I only want two things from you. He says, first of all, remove your hand from me so that I won't be terrified. And then secondly, verse 22, if I call, talk to me. Those two things, that's all I'm asking. Now, how many are my iniquities and sins? What have I done wrong? And he goes right back into this harangue. He starts just getting right at the Lord. He's so angry. Why do you hide your face, verse 24, and consider me your enemy? Will you cause a driven leaf to tremble? Will you pursue the dry chaff? For you write bitter things against me. Now here's his friends. I mean, they are just like with their mouths open. They've tried to shut him up and they can't. And so he just pours out this anger to the Lord. Chapter 14, he says, man who is born of woman, which includes pretty much all of us, is short-lived and full of turmoil. You got a short, unhappy life on earth. He wouldn't have said that a few months ago, but he feels like it now. When your life has gone flat, you realize life on earth is not the real reason for living. He goes all the way. He just is so depressed all the way down. Verse 7, he says, look, there's at least hope for a tree. He's asking that he be killed, and he says, there's at least hope for a tree. I'd rather be a tree. When it's cut down, it'll sprout again, and its roots won't fail. This is a sad guy. He wants to be a tree. Going down the food chain here, you know, down the ladder. Verse 13, oh, that you would hide me in Sheol. That's a request for God to kill him. And that you would conceal me until your wrath goes back to you, until it's done around here. Verse 18, but the falling mountain crumbles away. The rock moves from its place. Water wears away the stones. Its torrents wash away the dust of the earth. And that's the way you destroy humanity's hope. Whoa. Like a flood, Lord, you have destroyed my hope. You've washed me away, he says to the Lord. You forever overpower him, and he departs. You change his appearance, and you send him away. And his sons achieve honor, but he doesn't know it. He doesn't get to enjoy it. Or they become insignificant, but he doesn't understand it. And his body pains him, and he mourns only for himself. And he ends this one. We'll stop there, because the next series starts with Eliphaz. He jumps back on Job again in a minute, but he ends. He starts by, I got to talk to God, but the Lord is still quiet. And he ends by saying, I hate myself. I hate my life. Aren't you glad you know the end of the story? Because I tell you, it is depressing. And when you're in that moment where you just hate your life and you think there's nothing left, that's where Job was. And yet all through it, we know that the Lord knew he planned on blessing him. You know, brothers and sisters, if we could just remember at the lowest moment that the Lord still promises to bless, that we need to hang on and continue to trust him. I want to close with a couple of things to remember. If you are suffering, two pieces of advice. Brutal honesty is good, but be prepared to be corrected. It's okay to come to the Lord and beat your fists against his chest if you want to. He's really, really big. And if you belong to him, he loves you. You can come and you can say what's on your mind, but be prepared to be corrected. Now, that's looking forward into Job, but we know that the Lord does correct him and sort of says, Job, you're talking out of line there. You really don't understand me, and you had no reason. You had no real reason. From what you do know of me, you had no real reason to not trust me in this. And the Lord reminds him of that. But brutal honesty is good, but be prepared to be corrected. By the way, honesty is not the same as truth. Did you know that? Honesty is not the same as truth. You can be completely honest and absolutely mistaken. You can feel in your soul that a thing is this way, and then find out later it was 180 degrees in the opposite direction. It doesn't mean that you're a liar. It means that you were honest but mistaken. Honesty is not the same as truth. Only God is both honest and truthful at all times, because only He is omniscient. We are honest, or try to be as honest as possible at all times, but we are not always truthful. Is that not a strange phenomenon in a fallen world? So that's how a person can be really honest with you, and later you can wonder if they lied to find out the facts afterwards. But they were being honest as they could be at the time, perhaps. Honesty and truthfulness are two different things. You can be honest with God, but He will correct your understanding of truth as time goes by. And you have to understand that in honest prayer. You can say, Lord, I'm being totally honest. That doesn't mean you're correct in your assessment. So go ahead, be brutally honest with Him. Be honest in your prayers. It's a mark of people that know God, that they say to Him what is really on their minds. And very often, in the just letting it pass over your lips, it clarifies something in your mind when you say to yourself, I can't believe I said that to God. And that's probably Him saying that to you. I can't believe you said that to me. Now, how does that feel? Well, you're right, Lord. I'm sorry I said that. I've done that. I've prayed and said, Lord, you're right. I'm sorry I said that. That's a dumb thing to say. And then that helped me understand how dumb I was being about that particular situation. Honesty is good, but be prepared to be corrected, because honesty is not the same as truthfulness. Truthfulness is where real truth is. Honesty is simply our best shot at it. Also, if you're grieving, friendly advice is good, but be prepared to ignore a lot of it. Okay? If you're like Job and you're grieving and you're going through a time that you know other people cannot understand, this is just straight pastoral advice. And other people don't know what's going on in your soul. They don't know what you're facing. And no matter the fact that you try and explain it to them, they can't figure it out. They'll give you advice, and a lot of times their advice, though it is well-meant and it's because they love you, it'll miss the mark, sometimes widely miss the mark. And it'll make you feel worse than if they hadn't shown up. And you're thinking to yourself, oh boy, what a breath of stale air they've been. But you still have to smile. Okay, so here's a piece of advice. When you are suffering and people say dumb things to you, it's okay. It's okay. Be prepared to ignore most of it. It's okay to ignore it. It's okay to say that person just doesn't understand, and to realize they meant well, and just forget it. Just put it out of your mind. If it's just not, you know it's not right, you know they're missing it, put it out of your mind. It happens all the time. Friendly advice is good, but be prepared to ignore a lot of it. Okay, here's two pieces of advice, and we'll close with this. For the person, if you're a person who's helping someone face grief, you're a person who's helping someone like Job, okay, so you're one of Job's friends in a way. Two things. Number one, don't try to answer the question why. Never, ever, ever try to answer why, because your friend, no matter what, if it's a really horrible thing they're going through, they are asking why. They will ask it. Never answer it. And this, if I could just help us to help each other, never answer the question why. First of all, you will probably be mistaken because you really don't know why. But secondly, it won't help them. Explaining it won't help. See, this was Job's friend's problem. They thought that grief had to be explained. Grief doesn't have to be explained. It has to be experienced. And the best way to help a person experience it is just to be there with them. Do not answer the question why, even when they ask. They grab you by the shirt front. Why is God allowing this? Your answer is, I don't know. But I love you. Now, see, that's the important thing. I don't know why this is happening. And I don't think it's right either. I don't understand it. And I'm sorry. But I love you. That's what you got to do to people who are in deep, deep grief. Never answer the question why. You'll notice all of his friends are forever answering the question. That's why the book is so long, because they just keep saying it over and over. And here's the second piece of advice. If your friend is grieving, don't become short-tempered when your friend does not snap out of it. Don't become short-tempered when your friend does not snap out of it. Real grief, you don't snap out of real grief. People who are in real grief and think they've snapped out of it may have simply snapped. Okay? You don't snap out of real grief. I'm not kidding you. This is the reality. You don't snap out of it. You grow through it. You get over it. You become healed. But it's not an instantaneous thing. People who say, well, you know, I've lost a loved one, but I just don't feel any grief, and I think this is wonderful. You know, God has delivered me from the grief. Well, I just watch him for a couple of years because that's going to surface again. I'm not saying the peace that passes understanding isn't real. I'm not saying God doesn't give you peace. He does. What I'm saying is this, don't underestimate grief. So when you're counseling someone else who's going through this process, don't lose your temper with them. Don't get upset with them because they don't snap out of it. A rule of thumb, by the way, in dealing with people who've lost close loved ones is that they still feel horrible a year and 2 years afterwards, especially at certain times of the year when there's an anniversary of the date of the loss. You still feel that. And long after your friends have gone on, they've carried on with their lives, and they don't think there's anything significant about the black dot on your calendar for that day. And they don't understand it. And they might not understand why you feel that bad. Realize that happens so that if you're helping someone else and you love someone else and they've gone through that, you mark that and you be careful of that day. And you be careful of those things. Grieving, when you're going through grief, it's like stepping on landmines. Emotional explosions occur in grief, things you didn't expect that will set you back, or it feels like they're setting you back. It's actually part of the process you go through. Your friend is going to be stepping on landmines for a couple of years, maybe a lot longer even, if the loss was really, really traumatizing. And there will be things in their life where they'll start crying, they'll see a car, they'll smell a smell, they'll hear a song, and they can't get it out of their heads. And it's like one of those little landmines, boom, and it blows up in their heart. If you're a good friend, you will not lose your temper. You will not tell them to snap out of it. You will not tell them to get over it. They are getting over it. This is the process of getting over it. And we're talking serious grief here. We're not talking about lightweight things where there sometimes is a point that you can say snap out of it. We're talking about heavy-duty stuff, the loss of everything kind of feelings. Let's bow our heads and close our eyes. Father, thank you that you understand grief more deeply than we do. And thank you, Lord, that as Christians, we can face grief. It's so great, Lord, to tell stories and have a good time together and all laugh and everything, as we often are able to do. And yet, Lord, it's also wonderful to be able to talk about grief and to know that you understand it, that you want us to understand it, that our faith in you deepens us to this level. Teach us how to grieve. Teach us how to help each other grieve. Give us patience, Lord, wisdom for ourselves and for the people around us, so that when calamity strikes and you allow trials and you allow setbacks and tragedies that we cannot understand and would never have wanted, we at least can go through the process together. We can effectively minister to one another. Teach us, Father, please, how to do this. Because we are a redemptive people, and the hope of our lives is intact. Our life with you is indestructible. So we know that this is all temporary. Teach us how to deal with it, Father. We thank you for the wisdom found in the book of Job. Amazing wisdom. We trust you in Jesus' name. Amen.